by the goddess Durga. Vitam. The word spoken. Akaranya. By hearing. Kamsaha. Kamsa. Parama Vismitaha. Was struck with wonder. Devakim. Unto Devaki. Vasudevam cha. And Vasudeva. Vimucha. Releasing immediately. Prashritaha. With great humility. Abravet. Spoke as follows. So, translation. After hearing the words of the goddess Durga, Kamsa was struck with wonder. Thus he approached his sister Devaki and brother-in-law Vasudeva, released them immediately from their shackles, and very humbly spoke as follows. So you can repeat. After hearing the words of the goddess Durga, Kamsa was struck with wonder. Thus he approached his sister Devaki and brother-in-law Vasudeva, released them immediately from their shackles, and very humbly spoke as follows. So purport by his divine grace, A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Kamsa was astonished because the goddess Durga had become the daughter of Devaki. Since Devaki was a human being, how could the goddess Durga become her daughter? This was one cause of his astonishment. Also, how is it that the eighth child of Devaki was a female? This also astonished him. Asuras are generally devotees of Mother Durga, Shakti, or of demigods, especially Lord Shiva. The appearance of Durga in her original eight-armed feature holding various weapons immediately changed Kamsa's mind about Devaki's being an ordinary human. Devaki must have had some transcendental qualities. Otherwise, why would the goddess Durga have taken birth from her womb? Under the circumstances, Kamsa, struck with wonder, wanted to compensate for his atrocities against his sister Devaki. So, Daya vihitam akarnya Kamsa parama vismitaha Devakim vasudevam cha Vimucha prachuto Pravet. So, Omagana Tibananda Shah, Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshuru Meditam, Yena Tasmai, Shi Gurave Namaha. So, of course, this is one way of changing people's behavior, as they say in Christianity, to scare the bejesus out of them. I don't know where that expression came from. Anyway, to give them a good scare. And that scare can sometimes change a person's activities or consciousness temporarily, not permanently. But that temporary change can actually be an impetus to make a permanent change. And sometimes it's not an impetus to make a permanent change. Just like in the case of Kamsa here, he's scared. Oh my God, what did I do? I committed an offense. I better rectify the offense. But he continues committing offenses later. So, you know, he got a scare, but it was just a temporary thing. He forgot about it later on. Now, in other cases, we find people getting a scare, and they change their lives, like Magrari the hunter. Magrari the hunter was half killing the animals. I can tell the whole story, but anyway, he was half killing the animals, and he got a scare when Narada Muni put on his virtual reality glasses. They're called VR now, you know, goggles.
whatever.
And he was able to see his future. Actually, it's interesting in this story in Christianity, Christmas Carol or something like that. The ghost of Christmas past, the ghost of Christmas present, and the ghost of Christmas future. And he's Uncle Scrooge. He changed his whole attitude, and he became very hospitable and very nice, and helped, I think his name was Marley, if I remember correctly. Anyway, so you find this happens sometimes, someone makes a change. And so in the case of Magrari, after seeing this future that was awaiting him, he made a change. And he sat down and chanted Hare Krishna. Had that not happened, he would have reverted back to his original situation. Had he not chanted Hare Krishna, then it would have been over. Or the prostitute in Haridas Thakur, because she didn't really get a scare, she just got the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. Or Valmiki, and the story of Valmiki in the Ramayana, how Valmiki was taught by the Sapta Rishis about his future and his bad karma, and his family refused to accept any of that bad karma, and then he started chanting Mara, which became Brahma, so he became purified. The point is, one can come to Krishna consciousness through fear, and therefore you find in the Vedic literatures and in practically every religion there's some description of hell. You know, why is the description there? I mean, we're not going to talk about the ontology of hell, but why is the description of various hells? To scare people. So that at least they will follow moral principles. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about different grades of living entities. You know, there's immoral people, and there's moral atheistic people, and there's moral theistic people. And anyway, he gives us whole different grades of people in this world. So at least people will become moral and won't be committing vikarma. Nunam pramata kurte vikarma yanindriya priti aprinoti. Because the natural inclination of people having uncontrolled sense, which is about everybody, is to perform vikarmic activities. That means sinful activities that will get them a bad reaction. That's natural. You know, people are attracted to different tastes, for example. The Prabhupada said, one day they will discover how tasty human flesh is, and then they will just like go for it. I mean, just like even it's been revealed recently that they use something genetically connected or cloned of, I hate to use this expression, of babies, aborted fetuses, tissue, to flavor many, let's say, popular candy items. Yuck. So people are attracted to different tastes, you know. This is like, of course, that's called rasa. People are attracted to different tastes. It's a natural inclination for people to have illicit sex life. It's natural. You know, like the dog, you know, dog sees the she-dog. He doesn't think, is this dharmic or is it not dharmic? Of course, with a dog, it's always dharmic. I mean, it's just nothing wrong with a dog running after a she-dog, or a whole horde of dogs running after a she-dog when the dog is in heat. Nothing wrong with that, because that's animals. So the human being, these natural impulses are actually natural. You know, it's not that someone's not going to have them, but a human being has to be scared. Oh my God, if I break the four regulated principles, I will go to hell. I will have to embrace a red-hot form of the opposite sex. Like in the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, you have that. I don't want to do that. So, better I don't. Break the principles. Or if I drink liquor, you know, I will have to drink red hot iron. You know, not red, I've molten iron. Yamadutas. Or if I'm not nice to those devotees, boom. Then I'll be put through the sugar cane press. I mean, you got all these interesting descriptions. We gave a Sunday feast class about this. I'll get put through the sugar cane press, or, you know, any of these regulated principles, you know. Oh my God, if I'm stingy, I'm going to be stitched to cloth by the Yamadutas. All right, I will behave myself. Of course, this is really not a high platform, but, you know, at least it's better than nothing. And it's temporary, because the sinful desire seed remains, as description in the sixth canto, in the conversation between Pariksit Maharaj and Shukadeva Goswami, described as Kundra Sochara. You know, when one does atonement or stops his activities, one still has the tendency, desire, inherent in the heart. So it really doesn't work. So that's one aspect of motivation. Of course, another aspect, you know, people are motivated by different things. Someone may be motivated just to, because of false prestige, or someone may be motivated because of their emotive goodness. But ultimately, and even that's temporary. As Krishna describes in the Gita, the modes of nature in constant conflict. Sometimes the mode of goodness is prominent, defeating bad passion and ignorance. Sometimes passion is prominent, defeating ignorance and goodness. And sometimes ignorance is prominent, defeating passion and goodness. In this way, the modes are continually in flux. That's why the statement is there. Yashasti bhakti bhagavacha kinchana sabharguna stachra subhasate sura harava bhaktasya kuto mahadguna mano retena sati davata bahu bahi. The second part of that verse is haro abhaktasya kuto mahadguna. So one who is not a devotee, abhaktasya, then his or her so-called good qualities are on manovritti, not the asati. They're on the chariot of the mind. In other words, just like it's mental. He's not actually have good qualities because the modes of nature can control one. So, or one may be doing what they're doing. Another motivation I can think of right now is that one may be doing what they're doing or following the rules and regulations because they want liberation. And that's not permanent either. Because when one gets liberation, aruyika chena param padam, then ultimately they may fall down from that exalted platform. Even though they go to the Brahman refulgence, come down to the material world, engage in activities in the mode of goodness, and then ultimately be dragged down to lower modes. And so the only stable situation of following rules and regulations is devotion, out of love. I mean, that's the strongest force there is. I mean, of course, perverted reflection of that is lust. As that song goes, lust makes the world go round. It does. I know it's love, but it's actually lust. So one has to be doing things out of devotion. That's why bhakti yoga is actually much more potent, stronger, permanent than any other form of self-realization or any other type of motivation that one may have. You know, one concentrates, motivates, is motivated by pleasing the Lord and pleasing the Lord's pure devotee. Like you see Srila Prabhupada, his motivation was simply to please his spiritual master. And that was a very powerful motivation. He was able to do things that were incredible. As the greatest superhero, he was able to cross an ocean and in a boat at 70 years old, having heart attacks, and come into this weird country, God bless America, Hare Krishna, because of devotion. So that's really the point. So another point in this verse is that Prabhupada makes the point that Kamsa was a devotee of the demigods, especially Lord Shiva. So he very much respected Durga. You know, when Durga came, he very much respected her. And Prabhupada said you find this as a pretty much common denominator with many of the demons, that they're worshipping the demigods. And there's many stories about demons worshipping demigods in Vedic literatures. I mean, for example, you have Ravana, who was worshipping, first he was worshipping Lord Brahma, and he was so determined in worshipping Lord Brahma that ultimately when he didn't perceive Lord Brahma's presence, he was cutting off his heads and offering them as an offering to Lord Brahma. And ultimately Lord Brahma came, and Lord Brahma gave him the benediction, as we all know, of not being killed by any higher living entities. He didn't say anything about human beings and animals because he thought he was invulnerable from them. He wasn't capable of being killed by them. So you have Ravana. And then later on, he actually worshipped Shiva out of fear. It's an interesting story in the Ramayana. That Ravana, he wanted to establish, after he got his benediction from Lord Brahma, that he couldn't be killed by any demigods, he wanted to establish his supremacy over all the demigods, including Lord Shiva. So he goes to Lord Shiva's abode, Kailash, on his Pushpaka Vimana, which he had stolen from his brother, Kuvera, half-brother, Kuvera. And the Pushpaka Vimana, somehow or other, doesn't go forward beyond a certain amount because it can't enter Kailash. And so he starts to proceed on foot. And as he's proceeding on foot to Mount Kailash to show Lord Shiva that he's superior, that's interesting. Later on he did worship Lord Shiva. But anyway, to show Lord Shiva how superior he was, he encounters Nandi, who is Lord Shiva's bull. And he makes fun of the way Lord Shiva's bull looks. You're just ugly. And you're as ugly as a monkey, he says to him. And then Nandi curses him. He said, you're going to die because of a monkey or monkeys. When a monkey spits at your face, which actually happened later on. When Hanuman spat at Ravana. So anyway, so getting on with the story. So Ravana enters Kailash, and the first thing he does, you know, rather than worshiping Lord Shiva, is he picks up Mount Kailash with his hands, because he has 20 arms. He can manifest 20 arms, like 10 heads, you get 2 arms for each head. That's the deal. So he picks up Mount Kailash, and basically Mount Kailash starts to rock back and forth. Parvati gets upset. And Lord Shiva sticks his toe down and captures Ravana's arms beneath the hill. So Ravana, at that point, he's scared. But he's trapped. So he's trying to figure out, what should I do? So he starts to chant and worship Lord Shiva. I mean, some of the descriptions say that he actually uses intestines as like a violin or something like that. Like that. Of course, he couldn't pluck it; his hands were there. Anyway, whatever it was, he was trapped under Mount Kailash, and Lord Shiva ultimately frees him and gives him the Pashupatra, trident, Trishira. You know, he gives him his trident to fight. So he has the weapons. He has the weapons of Lord Shiva. But he worshipped Lord Shiva because Lord Shiva is scared of him, which is interesting. Also in the Ramayana, you have Lord Shiva's bow that when Lord Ram broke this bow right before at part of the Sita Swayamvar, the description of the Acharyas is that the bow was not broken by Ram, that the bow broke itself because it was Lord Shiva's bow and didn't want to be used against Ram or Vishnu. It's interesting. Anyway, so you got all these demigod stuff with the demons. So that's one story of the demigods and the or worship of the demigods by the demons. Another story that comes to mind is the story of, Vanasura. That's from the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. That Vanasura Oh, such an interesting story. Vanasura had been benedicted by Lord Shiva, so he had like 1,000 arms. It's even more than Ravana. So he was just like, I guess it was like a millipede or something like that. Millipede means like millipod, you know, so that's where it comes from, like 1,000 feet. You understand? Millipede, millipod. So it's, anyway, that's the linguistic derivation. So we have 1,000 arms. Whew. I don't know where he fit them all. It's hard to figure out, you know, where he had fit them all. And so what happened is that, I mean, it's a long story. Let's see, where should I start? I'll start with the story of Usha and Aniruddha. Like, Usha was his daughter, and she was very beautiful. She was protected, never allowed to see any man, but she was having dreams of this nice man. She had a mystic yogini friend, which helps. Chitraleka. It's interesting. We know a devotee named Chitraleka. Anyway, Chitraleka was showing her pictures of all the eligible men in the universe. You know, somehow or other she had a photographic album. She Googled it or something. I don't know how she did it. Anyway, she drew pictures. And finally, okay, oh, welcome. We're just telling a romantic story. So finally, they first you show a picture of Krishna, are you getting close? And then Aniruddha. Well, Aniruddha, wow. He's the guy. And so Chitraleka, using her mystic yogini powers, was able to transport Aniruddha to Usha's palace, you know, where she was protected. In those days, the ladies would never go out, you know, in public. I should probably even said, his mother, when she went out in a palanquin. You know, that means the sides were covered. Nobody saw her. Because that's not very practical nowadays. Nowadays, the ladies drive their own cars. Their own palanquins. But anyway, so Purusha was protected. You know, at most, they had like eunuchs. That means men who were not men, who took care of the ladies, you know, protected the ladies. So anyway, so this Chitraleka spirited Aniruddha there, and Usha was very happy having a relationship. It was discovered later on that she was having a relationship, and her father got really upset and eventually fought with Aniruddha, captured Aniruddha, and then Krishna had to come to the rescue. And in this case, you actually see Krishna not only opposing someone who was worshipping the demigods, but even fighting with the demigods. You know, usually, in most cases, like in a Ravana's battle with Ram, you know, it's not that Ravana actually had Lord Shiva like there on the battlefield fighting against Ram. But this is a really unusual case where Lord Shiva, in order to please his devotee, he came out on the battlefield. Not only did Lord Shiva come out on the battlefield, but Kartikeya, you know, like the general of the demigods. Can you imagine that? So basically, and then you had like mystic sages and all sorts of like entities from the higher planets fighting with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's pretty cool. I thought it was a really interesting story. Anyway, so they're fighting with Krishna, and of course, Krishna defeats Lord Shiva, and then story goes that Lord Shiva fires his Shiva Dwara, which has three legs and three eyes, three heads, I'm sorry. And the Shiva Dwara is so hot, it can burn up the whole cosmic manifestation. And so then Krishna releases his Vishnu Dwara, Narayana Dwara, and he cools him down. I mean, it's really interesting how this whole fight between Lord Shiva, the demigods, other demigods, and Krishna is there. And then ultimately, then Krishna, Narayana Dwara defeats the Shiva Dwara, cools him down. And then another thing happens, that an expansion of Durga, who is sometimes Kotura, who is sometimes considered to be Vanasura's mother, another demigoddess comes out. And some of the acharyas describe it's not a demigoddess, but anyway, you find some difference of opinion amongst the acharyas. And so another demigoddess, Kotura, comes out, and she just like appears before Krishna naked. And Krishna does, this is the ultimate deceptive technique. Krishna doesn't look at her and say, oh, that's cute. Because Krishna's a high-class person, he just looks away. And Bhanasura is safe for a few seconds. So I'll try. Such an interesting story, isn't it? And then ultimately, Krishna starts cutting off Bhanasura's arms, one after the other. Blup, 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 blup. And Lord Shiva comes forth and prays to Krishna. Which is interesting, because the Bhagavatam is filled with these stories, then there's a prayer, then there's a story, then there's more prayers. You see, the Bhagavatam is like a very tasty medicine. Like if you just had prayers, it'd be hard for people to relate to it. But the whole Bhagavatam is just full of prayers. So in order to attract people to Bhagavat, and of course the Bhagavat reciters don't get so much into the prayers, they just get into the stories. In order to attract the people to the prayers, then you have the stories. So the stories are interspersed with prayers. So what happens is that Lord Shiva prays to Vishnu, glorifies Vishnu, and says, please save Bhanasura. Krishna says, all right, because he's a descendant of Pallad Maharaj, I'm not going to kill him anyway, but he can only have four arms. And then there's the marriage ceremony. Everybody cools down, which is interesting. Right after all this fighting, they have a marriage ceremony. which I found extremely interesting. I guess it's just like Kshatriya mentality, isn't it? Like sometimes in marriage ceremonies you have gambling matches and people are killed. Isn't it like when Rukmi was killed by Balaram during a marriage? I mean, it's just Kshatriya life is really interesting like that. So anyway, so there's a story of a person who worshipped demigods so enthusiastically, the demigods, including Lord Shiva and the other demigods, took his part against Vishnu. Really interesting. And then another story comes to mind, another very, very interesting story, is the story of Shalva. And Shalva worshipped Lord Shiva too, and he got this amazing airplane. It's called Soba. Shobo. And this airplane was so amazing. It's like the modern day airplanes that you can't detect with radar. You understand? That are shaped in a certain way. And so this airplane, it couldn't be seen. It was invisible. And it was made, it's described in the Bhagavatam, it was made of iron. Which is interesting. So, like stealth, that's what they call now the stealth aircraft. And so it was like a flying city, and it was up in the air, and this Shalva, I remember Prabhupada listening to this story, Prabhupada would get so excited when he heard this story, he said, yeah, Krishna killed him. So, and Shalva was fighting with Prajuna, and he knocked Prajuna unconscious, Prajuna was taken off of a battlefield. I mean, all this different heroic stuff goes on. And that's another thing that it's really important for people, because people are attracted to heroic, people are attracted to romance, and then they can digest the philosophy of Krishna consciousness when they get all these things. That's why it's not just a philosophical text, it deals with the pastimes too. And Krishna is the most heroic, Mama Virya Sambhada, as described by Lord Kapiladeva. Krishna's vira means heroic. It's like my name in Sanskrit is Vira, not beer, although everyone teases me that my name refers as an alcoholic beverage. So Mama Viri, so anyway, so getting on with Shalva's airplane, and then Krishna ultimately, you know, knocks the airplane out of the air, kills Shalva, Shalva's friends, Dandavakra come, and Krishna kills them too. And you see the benefit of worshipping the demigods. So a lot of these stories also were told to show people that, you know, Kamastasta Vitigana, Prapujantaja Devata, those who are bereft of intelligence, worship the demigods. Yes, they get their fruits from the demigods, but the fruits are limited and temporary. And ultimately, if one worships Krishna, then one gets the real fruit, you know, Satchidananda, eternity, bliss, and knowledge. So here in this particular story, Kamsa is very impressed with seeing Durga, but you see, he's not ready to follow Durga's directions. That's another point. He's just scared of Durga, ready to apologize to Devaki and Vasudeva, but he's not making any change of heart or change of action at this particular juncture. So any questions or comments about these points? About the demigods, yes.
I was curious, at one point you were talking about, and I just need to clarify, like the fifth canto talks about the different
hells.
Hells of punishment and the price, chitta, and...
That's the sixth canto talks about price.
You know, and then I was just curious because part of what you were speaking about was like, you know, price chitta doesn't really work.
That's right.
Right, and so then... but then I also understand that these different things according to karma we do are because, not because of just for punishment, but to rehabilitate
That's right.
the soul. But if they don't really have an impact, because then what's the
problem? Ultimately, they have an impact. I mean, after you've been punished a few times,
right.
you get it. You know, like the saying goes, seen it, done it, been there. You know, sometimes it takes a few punishments. I mean, that's really not going to... The punishments are going to be an impetus to make a change.
Right.
But it's the change, especially the purification or purificatory process, that really does the trick. Not the punishments. It's not that one becomes pure because they're... I made that point in the beginning. Because they're scared of the punishments. One has an impetus to become pure.
So you accept the responsibility.
Yeah, well, first of all, you accept the responsibility, and then you realize it's not just working, so I have to make a change in life. But the real change is bhakti. Every other change, the point I was making, is that every other motivation is temporary. Like, even like, you know, we hear Krishna describe in the Gita, the reason people come to him, Chatur Vidha, a famous verse. People come, people come because they want wealth. People come because they're inquisitive. People come because they want knowledge. People come because they're in distress. And those are just impetuses, but they're not permanent. They don't permanently keep one in Krishna consciousness. No, it's just still self-centered. You know, ultimately, bhukti mukti siddhi kam sakalaya shanta. Krishna bhakti nis kam atayiva shanta. So, ultimately, you know, yes, it's an impetus. You know, here's the devil. You know, like they do in Christianity. You're going to hell. Ooh, I don't want to go to hell. Let me get baptized. And so, you know, it's good. It's something. It's a step. But then ultimately, you know, as they say in Christianity and Judaism, you have to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and all thy might. That's Sharanagati right there. So if they don't come to that point, then they can regress. And also, another thing is a devotee, even if he takes up Krishna consciousness and starts chanting, because of fear or whatever reason, you know, and if he neglects the chanting, then there's the Purnamurti Kababa, he becomes like he was before. So there's also that too. So the ultimate thing that only, that keeps, at least it's my experience, at least the Shastric experience, is the sense of bhakti, the sense of pleasing someone like that. And that steadiness. Just like I see, you know, even, I mean, talk about my mother. Like my mother, it's just been so many years, and she's still like, I'm just like her deity, practically speaking. She's 91 years old, even though I joined the Hare Krishna movement. I'm still her deity, you know. Because that's love. Even though I did everything against her desire. Not everything. Most things. Anyway, into it. Everything. Everything with it. I'd have to be a criminal to do everything. But anyway, so, because that's love. And, you know, Krishna, you may crush me by your embrace. Krishna, you may leave me brokenhearted by not being present before me, but I'll worship you unconditionally. Isn't it? I mean, that's love. And that's steadiness. And that's the only way one can become absolutely free from anarthas. Because that one has that devotion. One's motivation. Here we're talking about motivations. What is your motivation? What is my motivation? Is it, you know, am I doing this because I like people listening to me in class and you know, putting on a show for everybody? Or am I doing this to please Prabhupada, to please the deity? So I have to always examine my motivations. And unless one has that pure motivation, or at least aspiring to come to the pure motivation and following Krishna consciousness, there's every chance that one will deviate. It's just like, you know, the fear of hell. It's every chance that one's going to deviate. You know, Kamsa, you know, he did deviate, I mean, pretty quickly after that. You know, Durga appeared to me. It probably would take me a few months before I deviated. Isn't it? You know, Durga says, oh my God. All right, I better make some changes and chant my rounds now. Right? I mean, it'd be pretty frightening. Just think about it. You know, and Durga appears to you. Okay, what should I do, Durga? I'll follow your instructions. I mean, that would be my response. Constant didn't have that response. He was scared, but it wasn't really a change of heart experience for him. What's that?
Because I'm thinking bhakti uncovers, you know, our real desire, so are the punishments also meant to, like, remove layers?
The punishments are meant to ultimately get us to the point to do bhakti. Otherwise, punishments have no place, and you don't get punished anymore. What you may perceive as punishment is just Krishna taking away everything, so you just surrendered it. Yashaham anagrinami harishyeta dhanamshana. It's not a punishment, that in that case, not karma. It's just like Krishna just said, okay, Hare Krishna. Okay, on that happy note of being punished by Krishna and having everything taken away,